Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, and some degree of science, maybe not as much as usual, because tonight we're going to talk about spiritual leaders and teachers, although there's a lot of science involved in that, even though it doesn't seem like it on the surface. And then also we'll be talking about elements of metaphysics and how those issues intertwine with physics itself, as far as it deals with this subject. Let me first of all start off, as I usually do, with some defining elements to what the show's about. So when I say leaders and teachers, these have very, very specific meanings when we are discussing them in relationship to their function within what I call spiritual groups. So let's start off with that. What the heck is a spiritual group, right? I've defined it a number of ways, but pretty much the same. A spiritual group is a group of people who may not know that they are a spiritual group, but function as such because they are attempting to increase the thought in mind of God within their reach of what they can do within the dimension of time and space that they live in. So people who are alive in the physical world are members of spiritual groups, even though they may have no idea what that means, because they are trying to increase virtue, which is light in form, or God's thought within form. And they do so in the activities that many other people are doing similarly, but without the motive of being, we'll say, enlightening in the process of what they're doing by increasing virtue. And so spiritual groups are people who do many of the same things in a group together that many other people do, but call them businesses or call them some kind of research or some kind of specific, we'll say, function that may be part of a government or part of a educational system, part of almost any walk of life, maybe part of a church or a synagogue. They may be part of or a mosque. They may be part of a business organization. In all of those elements, and a vast amount of others, they are attempting, if they're spiritual, to bring virtue, more light and form, in the activities that they carry out, regardless of the other interests that they have. So, with that idea, with that thought in mind, then what do the leaders and teachers of these kinds of, we'll call them spiritual groups, do? Because if the people don't even know their spiritual groups, how would they know if they're spiritual leaders or teachers? And the answer is, most do not. This is so fascinating that what we call spirituality, for those that are practicing it, the majority do not know that's what they're doing. They wouldn't use that as the primary definition of who or what they are doing. So many of the spiritual leaders and teachers do so in a capacity in which it is subconscious to them. It isn't even the primary emphasis of what they do, but yet, if you look at it deeper, you see that it actually is. In other words, it's more important for them to be virtuous and to help enlighten the world than maybe the other parts of what they are doing are. Isn't that fascinating? And yet, and they might be able to address that. They might say, yes, that's true, that's what I think. But they still might not call what they do a spiritual group. So it's a fascinating, fascinating way of looking at it. Now, there are some exceptions to this general rule. People who are leaders or teachers of groups that specifically teach spiritual issues and have a founding in what I call ageless wisdom probably do know that they are leaders and or teachers in spiritual groups. Now, I want to get to the basis of what I mean by leaders and teachers. Generally speaking, and this is mostly true, leaders are separated from teachers. There are some in some types of young and less evolved in consciousness spiritual groups, leaders and sometimes teachers can get put together because neither are very good, are very well, I should say, represented. And they're not good at doing the things that do the enlightenment because, unfortunately, their consciousness is just budding and not really developed enough. So their ability of teaching and or leading is not very much, and they might cross the boundaries. But I'm going to talk about these boundaries tonight because they play important roles in making who and what a leader and a teacher is. And this is so critical because I think it's pretty much esoteric, meaning it's hidden or unknown to most people. So, again, people who might benefit from tonight are people who are actually functioning as leaders and teachers and don't even know they are. At the same time, they may not know all of the different things I'm going to discuss this evening. I have covered some of these subjects before, of course, but tonight there'll be, I think, a little different of an angle and some things that you may have never heard before. So anyway, let's continue on. What is it that I mean by a leader? Well, a leader of a group is primarily concerned with helping others within the group to perform or function in ways that are more spiritual. They aren't so much concerned about the thought of those they are dealing with, although they certainly would like them to think as much like God or in a spiritual way as possible. But they aren't continually involved with that part because that's what a teacher does. They're concerned that regardless of the thoughts of the people within the group and others as well, by the way, who may function outside of it, their thought is focused on helping others to behave and create and to interact in ways with others, both in the group and outside, that in some way produces more virtue and is usually in coincidence with the teacher and what the teacher is attempting to bring into consciousness within the development of consciousness within the people. The interesting thing about this is that the teacher doesn't exactly teach by our standards anyway, and we'll say the more non-spiritual parts of society, the more mundane elements as we look at them in society. What do I mean they don't teach? Well, think of it this way. Most people think of teachers as imparting certain knowledge that then helps people to perform certain activities and to be able to, in some cases, think a little better as well. Those kinds of teachers are mundane teachers, but spiritual teachers, they don't do that. What is it that a spiritual teacher does? A spiritual teacher attempts to raise consciousness in those that are, quote-unquote, either learning or students of the teacher's kinds of consciousness. They adopt some elements of the teacher's consciousness and attempt to grow it in their own way. Now, this is very different than we think of as knowledge, because knowledge is imparted and copied, whereas consciousness is borrowed to some extent and then created much further by the person who is attempting to expand their consciousness. consciousness cannot be replicated from one person to another. You can't teach people how to be conscious. You can only teach people to attempt to create more consciousness within themselves. That's a toughie. And it also means that people have to be free to think on their own if consciousness is the goal, which it should be, of a spiritual teacher. And if you think about this from another standpoint, then a leader of a group is doing something special as far as their consciousness is concerned to help others to then behave with whatever level of consciousness they have chosen to create for themselves in ways that is more virtuous within and without, in the world in general, of the spiritual group. It's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? It's really different than what we think of as the mundane leader, mundane teacher. These are really different kinds of definitions. So now, when we examine how that works, then how does the leader manage to get somebody, you know, I mean, what do? They hold a gun to people's heads and say, you do this or else, or maybe get a bullwhip, or maybe scream and yell. Those are all inappropriate in general. Not to say that some leaders don't sometimes possibly resort to such things, but I'm suggesting that if you're being a spiritual leader and you're functioning in a way that truly is spiritual, those operant ways, while sometimes maybe misapplied, are not the ways that are to be used. The first and foremost way, are you ready for this? That a leader leads a spiritual group is by example of the consciousness that they grew from their understanding of the teacher's consciousness to begin with. So they understand something from the teacher's consciousness. By understanding it, they become it, but then they must grow it and become an example of the growth within themselves to be able to be an example to others in the group to help lead them. Yeah. Okay, did you follow all that? If you didn't, I'll say it again. How's this? Let's try it one more time because that was pretty fast. And a lot of people go, huh? What did he say? Okay, let's try it like this. Let's use an example. Let's say that you, whoever you are out there, would like to lead some people. And they may be a part of a spiritual group you're in, or maybe they're not necessarily in a spiritual group with you, but you still may see you as a leader to their level of spirituality. And you come to them and you say, here is how I understand it. You verbalize it, and then through your actions, you show how that consciousness allows you to change your behavior so that you're more virtuous and more serving to others, in or out of the spiritual group, and that you are functioning more in a way which we call soul consciousness, which means that your focus is not on yourself personally, but on helping others to be soul conscious themselves. So that's what you do. And you do it because you've got a teacher, fortunately, you hope. And that teacher, you take some of the teacher's consciousness, which, because you're able to understand the teacher a little better than the other folks are, you can take it inside yourself and you grow it. You have to grow it. You have to make it yours, so to speak, which makes it bigger. And your unique new understanding from it shines to the others, who then say, whoa, look at that person. They're doing something very special. The interesting thing about this is most of the other people in a more advanced group do not see the teacher very well. They know they got a teacher. They may even have an agreement with that teacher that they're going to be a student and try to borrow some of his or her consciousness. But it's the leader that has a 30% or generally in that number or more understanding percentage-wise of the teacher's consciousness and then is able to grow it by a few percent or more. And it's that person, it's the leader that the group sees. They don't see the teacher for the most part. Whoop, right by them, they're gone. The leader does. The leader then takes it and expands upon it, and it's the expansion that makes it noticeable to the other people in the group. Wow. You see how that works. And it's this is consistent. In other words, this is not like, oh, this is a special case, it only happens once in a while. This happens over and over and over again almost every day. And it has tremendous benefits for both the leader, who is expanding her or his consciousness, while others in the group or that are around this leader, even if they're not specifically in the group, are able to then adopt and understand it so much better than if the just the teacher was there. Plus, if the teacher was there, the teacher cannot do what the leader does. The teacher is actually prohibited, especially if it's a thing called a big teacher. I'll get into this concept in a few minutes. But that teacher cannot directly try to get the other people of the group to behave any other way, because the teacher is only attempting to help others raise consciousness and not necessarily change behavior to be more virtuous. Now, why not? You know, a lot of people say, well, what's wrong with that? Why couldn't a teacher be a leader? Why can't the teacher just do both sides? One minute the teacher has the hat on, helping others to raise their consciousness, and then next minute takes off that hat and is a leader and is going to do something to help get that person to do something about it. Well, there's a trick that the leader employs that is different from the teacher. The leader not only uses themselves as an example of expanding consciousness, but they also are, at least in an equal amount or greater, an example of sacrifice, self-sacrifice. And that example of self-sacrifice is what triggers oftentimes the other, quote-unquote, people surrounding that leader, either in or out of the group, to take action. The sacrifice becomes the catalyst for others saying, if that person's in, I'm in. You know, because look at what the sacrifice they're making, I'm willing to go that far. They become that. And teachers are, they make great, great sacrifices, but their sacrifices are so great that they fall completely outside, as if they're this thing called a big teacher, completely outside of the awareness of virtually all the members except the leader can notice him. So it's like, as far as the general members, they don't see the sacrifices of the teacher because they're so big, their level of awareness is too low to take notice of it. They don't get it, so to speak. And the leader, because the leader has higher consciousness, and also senses that somewhat match, can somewhat notice, sometimes fully or sometimes different levels, the sacrifice of the teacher. Ah, so the sacrifice is the trigger, and the big teacher doesn't pull the trigger most of the time for most people because their senses don't work very well around that that teacher at the level to notice it. That the more something is beyond our consciousness, the harder our senses are to take notice of it. That's a general principle. And so this really applies in this specific circumstance. You can see how you go, whoa, that would not work then. Most people wouldn't see. So if you don't have a leader in a spiritual group, and you have particularly a thing called a big teacher, but any teacher actually, it's going to be very hard for the members and even non-members, anyone who comes in contact with that teacher, to be aware of the sacrifices that teacher makes. And it's a sacrifice that is the trigger that encourages people to change. So they don't change if they don't have the trigger. The trigger usually comes from the leader because of the sacrifices the leader makes. Now, you could say, well, okay, then everything's dependent upon the leader. All the teacher has to do is just teach, and that's it. It's not exactly that way, because there's a couple other principles, which I'm going to explain, that also make up this whole picture. I'm trying to build this so to keep it simple, because this is a little more complex than it seems on the surface. Okay, what is the complexity here? Well, let's remember that the teacher is supposed to help the students and non-students become more conscious. And consciousness has to do with love. It has to do with the thing of called universal, unconditional love. And if a person has more of that, they then have developed consciousness from usually the quote-unquote teaching of the teacher. This is where it gets dicey, you see. Some of the problems that teachers can have is that the people around them, students or otherwise, first of all, don't see them very well, because, again, the awareness issue is about, and they're teaching. The better the teacher is, in some weird ways, the teaching is more and more esoteric, and sometimes, beyond by a considerable level, that of the student or others that are around that teacher. And a misunderstanding of the teaching may occur, or a complete non-understanding. In other words, you don't get it, right? And this happens not because a teacher is a, we'll say, just no good at teaching, but because the teacher is trying to teach things that are so advanced, they may be very difficult to understand. And worse, those around the teacher, both students and non, may make misunderstandings. In other words, it isn't just that you don't get it. Okay, not getting it is just not getting it. But they take what they hear and they confabulate or make up a personal understanding which may reverse or obscure or even negate the original meaning to the teacher's teaching. That's obviously a bad outcome. How often does that happen? Well, it depends on the level of the students in comparison to the level of the teacher. There's one particular kind, especially of a big teacher, that this is an enigma throughout the entire lifetime that big teacher functions in. It's a real mess. And when that happens, usually the group fails, the students don't get very far, and a lot of things come crashing down, all because of this one thing I just mentioned. So we'll get to that, too. I'll explain that. But I'm trying to just get the very basics here so we can understand that this is not a subject that is one-sided or a single side or two sides. It's pretty deep. It's got a lot of different elements to it. So it's not so easy to just quickly define and explain this whole thing, because there is so many, we'll say, exceptions and unusual circumstances that happen in the lives of people that are following a spiritual path of some sort. All right. Now, what then can a leader do in mitigating some of these more problematic areas? Well, we know that leaders are supposed to raise their consciousness and act as examples, and they also are supposed to make great sacrifices. And those sacrifices are supposed to be encouragements for others to continue to do so. There's a third element to the leader, and that is the limitation element. Whenever a person makes a sacrifice, they put a limitation, and it has to be some limitation that they agree to onto themselves, and that limitation will reduce some sense, not increase it, because they're going to need to improve or discipline some element of their senses. And in order to do that, they're going to have to give up some other sense for a while to focus on the senses that aren't working correctly. That's all called spiritual discipline. And when that is done, and done in a way that is, we'll say, convincingly and with great willingness on the person doing it, the likelihood is that they will grow and be able to, we'll say, make the sacrifices that they at first had some resistance to. Leaders tend to encourage this limitation issue. Most of the time they do so by suggestion. Rarely, when things are really out of hand and someone is maybe risking the life of themselves or others, they may actually apply what we call some degree of verbal force. What is verbal force? Verbal force is a warning or a great concern. And they may also bring the rest of, or some, or all of the other members and non-members that are connected to whatever they're doing together to try to put in perspective to the person who is, we'll say, needing some help to get through the discipline spiritually, so they can use it. But they can't, and they're not supposed to use any physical force, and they're not even supposed to use any threats or verbal of a verbal nature. That doesn't always turn out to be the way it works in real life, because people are sometimes angry and frustrated, which is a form of anger, in people being unresponsive to spiritual life and wanting to be selfish about a number of areas. Unfortunately, for the teacher, there's little the teacher can do. But for the leader, they have to walk a fine line between what it takes to help someone to discipline themselves and it becoming an autocratic system of the quote-unquote teacher doing the discipline. Very difficult thing. And it's usually done best when it's a collective effort of everybody working towards a common goal rather than a one-on-one situation. You do this or else kind of thing. Now, that's not really a good way to go about it. As you know, I believe that people need to be free and free to think for themselves and make these choices. Now, once they make them, there's no question a leader can encourage them and can help them and can make suggestions which may be seemingly very limiting, but they should not be punitive. Now, in all of those elements, leaders are critical because the teacher is impotent. Whether they're a little teacher or a big teacher, they're going to find themselves unable, ill-equipped, to be able to help others to discipline themselves spiritually and to find their consciousness and try to make it expanded so that they understand more and then at the same time do behaviors, interactions with others that are virtuous. It's a toughie. The teacher will find themselves almost always in a conflict to attempt to do that. And it's not recommended that teachers be leaders in any circumstance. Tough role to play. Okay, so if a teacher actually is, we'll say, almost forbidden from leading, then a leader is, in some respects, not supposed to teach. Now, this gets strange because people say, well, they teach by example, so isn't that teaching? No. The leader is supposed to be able to help others to gain the teaching of the teacher, but not necessarily to become the teacher themselves until the point is reached where they're ready to, the baton is given to someone else as a leader, and then you have co-teaching going on. You can have as many teachers as you want in a group, but they all must give up their role of leadership if that is going to be what they're going to do. Many of you may be surprised by all the things that I'm saying tonight because they seem so unbelievably counterintuitive to normal teaching. But in reality, based upon metaphysical principles and science of psychology, this is really in the mundane world, if it were followed correctly meaning following the ways I'm suggesting, we would have much better schools, teaching, etc., with people having much greater respect for leaders all at the same time. And it would really, it would bring a new order, we'll say, education. It would permit people to much more quickly develop their consciousness and their willingness to sacrifice for creation of more and more virtue in their lives and the lives of others. And that's why it would be a great thing to adopt on a mundane level. We're pretty far from that because the mundane teaching involves so many personal issues. They interfere with the soul development. And until we can get over that and not be so personally involved in the teaching process, then we wouldn't have all the defensiveness and the need to be right so often that many teachers employ, the arrogance, the lack of insight and understanding of the students and of their students, and the conflict that sometimes imposes itself on a system of those kinds of problems. Many times teachers are hated or disrespected, which is a problem. Many times they are reviled as being something they're not. So you end up with these kinds of, we'll say, illusions that show their head because, unfortunately, when people are personally invested in what they're doing, such as a profession or occupation, rather than a truly spiritual way of living, they can't usually get outside of their small sphere of thinking and consciousness. And this kind of thought process of how to teach eludes them. And even if it didn't elude them and someone said, well, here's how you got to do it, they would probably have great trouble if they could do it at all, with tremendous resentment, hostility, and who knows what else, because they would think that it's being imposed upon them, and they would resent and rebel in that aspect. This is the tough part. Spiritual has with it an understanding of God itself, and it is very obviously connected to God, and some mundane teachers don't believe in God, and further may have hostility for those who might. So it's not an easy road to hoe, and we can't expect that the things that I'm presenting this evening can easily be applied to the mundane world and mundane teaching. Quite the opposite. There's a great deal that needs to change within that sphere for that to be a common way for people to, we'll say, be able to teach. I think we're maybe 100, 200, I hope not more than that, years away from that being a form of teaching that we would universally see applied. I would love to live in a place, a country, a world, that has that a spiritual teaching as a norm and spiritual leaders as a norm. It would be a wonderful place to be. We have some work ahead of us to present that. There is also a great deal of misunderstanding and animosity towards spiritual leaders and teachers. Anything from calling them cult leaders, which obviously they're not. I'll explain that, what a cult is. Again, I do it frequently. And then if they're not cult leaders, then they are weirdos or wackos or some kind of derogatory element in society. Nothing could be further from the truth. They are the most compassionate, loving, helpful, serving, sacrificial people around. But they don't usually get any credit for any of those things from the, we'll call it, just the average masses of people. It's just not within their consciousness to see these people from that perspective. Too bad. So, as we move ahead this evening, then, let's kind of sum up what I said in my defining elements for this first part of the show. All right, you have leaders and you got teachers. They really are not the same thing. Leaders lead by three different components. They lead by example, which means they take some of the teaching of the teacher in the group and they can absorb it better, they can understand it better, and they can then make it their own by creating something more in themselves from that level of consciousness, expanding it a bit further within themselves. And then others say, wow, look at her, look at him, look at what's going on. And they notice, but they don't notice it in the teacher so much as they do in the leader. So the leader is like the transformer, can take what is taken as too high for most and bring it to a level where they can sense it, they can see it, and they say, wow. Then secondly, the leader is a great sacrificial person who is able to, through spiritual discipline, should help increase their senses by giving up some things that are not good for them and not good for others, but they may have some compulsion or habits or desires, feelings, that they don't want to give up to continue with without making the great sacrifice to do so, because they're doing it for the betterment of others, not for the betterment of them personally, but because they see it as a way of serving other people. And finally, the leader is a person who is willing to take responsibility for all the other people around them, and to, within that responsibility, to try to help them in every way possible, for them to make sacrifices, and for them to behave in ways that are conducive towards enlightenment, but at the same time, they will not forcibly prevent others from thinking in a certain way, and only would do so about behaviors that are really dangerous for the others and anyone else. They have to protect the lives and self-preservation of others, but only within that bound can they intervene. And when they do so, they cannot be autocratic. They have to do so with the help of others, and usually with the almost unanimous support of others. So they've got these, that's a real big chunk for someone to take into themselves. And then in addition to that chunk, the leader now cannot do those things. So the leader cannot. The teacher cannot. And the teacher's job is to truly teach by expanding consciousness in new and greater ways, by being able to expand his own consciousness, at the same time letting others understand what that means and making sure that they can connect it to God, which means it's a spiritual level of function. And when they do that, they are the greatest of all teachers, because they're doing something that is connected to the creator of the universe. So that's something to think about. We will be back and talk a lot more about this subject in about 2.5 minutes or so from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. So tonight we're talking about spiritual leaders and teachers, and I just defined, I hope, well enough, what a spiritual leader and teacher is in general. Now I'm going to add a little monkey in the wrench, or a little wrench in the monkey, and talk about that there's really different levels of leaders and teachers. Yeah, you may not have known that. Some of you do if you've heard some prior show that I've done on this subject. And let me get into this by saying that the gist of what I said in the last 40 minutes was correct. But you have to now apply it to these different levels of consciousness. Leaders of, we'll call them first and second level initiate groups, and or groups that are not even at that level, those kinds of leaders oftentimes have their moments when they can lead according to what I explained, but they may have lots of moments when they cannot. So we should not hold this high standard to every kind of spiritual group, because some of them are in their infancy and people are not that conscious, and others have much higher levels. So it depends. But generally, the main difference is more often not in just the consciousness, but also in the willingness to make sacrifice. In groups where people generally stay for just a few years, also called group service groups, involve themselves in service with other groups. And they could be involved with dozens or hundreds of other groups. And sometimes they serve a few groups that are many times more advanced than they are, and sometimes they serve groups that are more pretty much at the level they are. Those groups, those relatively, we'll say, prolific groups, there's a lot of them, have sometimes very high numbers of members. They come and go anywhere from every year or two to every 5 years or so. And the leaders of those groups may not remain leaders for much more time than that. Sometimes they'll hang on for double the time. So sometimes you'll have a leader of those groups that might be around for up to 10 years. But beyond that, it's hard to find those groups with leaders any further ahead, any more than that. Because you're not committed enough to the service that the group is supplying, whatever it may be. And they don't know that it's really a spiritual group, as I said so often. And even if they did, it may not matter. They just aren't going to last that long because most of the members don't. The majority of members are gone in half the time that the leaders are. So it's a continuous revolving door. And because of the lack of commitment to the level of sacrifice required, the leaders, therefore, are on shaky ground at best. And when they leave, there's a gap. And usually someone takes over, but for a year or two, it's almost like the group barely has a leader. That's a difficult situation, but it's the truth. And the way it happens most with group service groups. Groups that are national service, where they're mostly serving in national interests, and especially world service groups, those groups tend to have leaders that stick around for a much longer period of time. In a national service group, you might find a leader there for half of their lifetime, which is no small feat, believe me. And in world service groups, it's usually a commitment for life, but they may not all stay that long. So it's a real, and when they don't, they can crash and burn because they burn out. They literally, it's too much for them. And so leaders are in a strange position there. The ones that last a whole lifetime now are, you know, to be tremendously given appreciation for their valiant efforts, more in sacrifice than just in redevelopment of consciousness, although both may be true, obviously, if they're leaders. And the amount of work that they do is sometimes so heavily involved that it takes just a tremendous amount. But at the same time, the growth that they have from all that they do in service now is just, the growth in from service is dramatic. So leaders can benefit tremendously from that. Now, so we have leaders, and some people call them little leaders, some people call them big leaders, but there's a mix between, there's different levels among leaders, so it's hard just to segregate them into two standards. Now, teachers, it's much easier. There's a little teacher, and there's the big teacher. Now, what's a little teacher? A little teacher is someone who is willing to raise their consciousness usually in one or two ways. Specifically, usually involved in focusing on one or two of their senses more than others, and they usually develop into a relatively narrow but a big teacher. They can be, not a big teacher, I'm sorry, but a narrow teacher, but a teacher who has, we'll say, the willingness to do something on a somewhat extraordinary level. And it's important to realize that these teachers in the past have sometimes been saints. Now, what is a saint? Well, a saint takes example of extreme levels to what I just defined. And a saint is someone who perfects a certain sense, usually in a mental way, and sometimes in an astral as well. They oftentimes break a thing called the karma monastic connection, in connection with that sense, maybe not all the senses they have, but that one, and they use it in an extreme way that is of great service, but very narrowly so. That's what we have called saints in the past. There are very few people doing that any longer. It takes such a high level of devotion and such a, we'll say, a willingness to be subservient to some higher authority, usually God, that today with the passing of the sixth ray being in focus, it's a hard thing for saints to be saints. And so we don't have too many. We have almost none, actually. So it's a real, it's a big deal. Now, taken to the extreme level, some people go way beyond the saint level, and they actually balance out or become truly big teachers. Big teachers now are the ones who, in every way, they try to balance the level of growth in their sense and in their consciousness so that they may reach a level called Buddhic thought. But there's two different kinds, really, of big teachers. One who teaches mostly from monastic thought and mental plane thinking with occasional but infrequent forays into the intuitional mind. They may hit once in a blue moon, and not always in complete control. Buddhic thought. Those teachers are usually what are called third-level initiates. And some of them, almost all of them, to reach even that level, usually have gone through a process called the 18 renunciations, a whole different subject. But regardless, they're free from evil, and they teach mostly from their mental self. And they usually write and teach great things, great thoughts, but not so profound that it's going to be like earth-changing, earth-shaking. But they're still called big teachers, by the way. Usually they go through that period of time in one or two lifetimes. And each time, any big teacher is doing a life, they have to pass through everything they did before they can move ahead. So it's like you relive in a year or two all the tests you had in a whole lifetime before. That's a pretty big thing. I guess it was quite a stirring accomplishment if you think about it. Okay, so that's a big teacher, but one who is in one level. And then there's a big teacher that gets beyond the mostly mental part of what they create, and they mostly are in Buddha consciousness, both when they teach, and it's called a controlled state of intuition, and the things they teach about are a bit more profound, oftentimes unique and revealing. A revelation is probably the biggest element of their teaching process. And sometimes they're called that. They're called teachings of revelation, or revelation teachings. And they also are teachers who are really advanced initiates. They're usually arhats. Well, what's that? Well, if they are at the beginning stage of the arhat, they usually, the very first life they get into being an arhat, which is usually, there's only two or three lives they're going to have as an arhat, usually. And so what's going to happen is, the first life, they are expected to fail. And part of their experience is to deal with failure in a human sense. Because spiritually, there's no such thing as failure, really. But in terms of their perspective, they have to get over the illusion of failure. And so, to get over the illusion of failure, they have a life of failure. And how do they do that? If they're a teacher and they're coming up with profound things, well, nobody notices them, of course, because they can't see them very well. And the other thing is their students usually don't. So their students oftentimes reject them, etc. And that causes all kinds of issues, you know. For those of you who have some understanding of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, somewhat different than Jesus the Christ, but it's a whole different issue, and I don't want to get into that tonight. But anyway, Jesus the man, okay, was in that strange position of being an arhat. But he was an arhat in the third level initiation because at that time it hadn't advanced that far. So there's a little bit of confusion about that. But yeah, if you think about it, what did all his students do to him except Mary? And even people don't know this unless they read the Testament of Mary, which is no longer in the Bible. But if you read it, you can understand the difference. Anyway, except for Mary, all of the rest of his students did what? They denied him. They said, no, I don't know. Who are you talking about? Jesus who? Aren't they killing him right now? Well, I don't want to have anything to do with him. Well, you know, they denied his right as a teacher. But that's normal. That's considered, that's part of the process. In this uniquely, you know, big teacher life, which happens one time, thankfully, and is not usually repeated, but it's a nasty life. I mean, it's about as bad as it can get. And again, even those great beings, these arhats, still have to go through all of the other stages, relive the crises they had in earlier lifetimes as teachers. So it isn't like they even get a reprieve from that. They got to go through all the crap over again from the last life, and then they got to deal with some relatively unique problems that are very challenging in this one life where they get the worst of the worst of the worst kinds of students who are barely able to function as students and who do terrible things to themselves, the teacher, the group, sometimes to others in the world. It's one of those kinds of things that you just don't want to think about, right? Oh, man, I hope I never have to do that. But when you get to it, it's kind of voluntary. So, yeah. All right. So these big teachers have a whole parcel full of troubles and problems, and yet what they're supposed to do is create new knowledge. That also helps to develop and create new understandings. In other words, a new way for people to be conscious. And some of them might even have some other roles to play. But regardless, they are these, you know, the greatest of teachers. And eventually you get through that one life, and in the next life you get the best of students, which is a whole other thing. okay, now you've one life, you lead a life of failure, and nobody knows who the heck you are because they can't see you, and you just disappear into the whatever. And in the next life, you become one of the most well-known people. You might become a world leader. But it doesn't mean that you have an easy life either. Because, again, these people have to create themselves into members of the next kingdom, all by themselves. Now, I know some people think it comes from the next kingdom doing something. That's true in the lower levels of what is called initiation and spiritual discipline. But at this high, high level for a human being, it's all up, at the very end, it's all up to the human being to, believe it or not, do it themselves. Now, I know that sounds impossible, because you may have read things like, oh, well, you've got to get these energies from the masters and from others, and the planetary logi and the logos and the sun and the logos. Yeah. Well, some of that has some truth if you're not dealing with the most advanced of these arahats. But no, when you get to their level, they got to do it themselves. There's no one's going to, even the solar angel, which is virtuous like the soul, the companion of the soul, this associates itself so that the human can be on their own. Now, that's a tough one, because we don't even know what we welcome. Humans in general don't know what it's like to not have direct contact with your soul. It's a tough one. So it's a very tough one. Okay, so within this, big teachers have the hardest sacrifice, and they contribute the most to developing consciousness. But others have some of the most difficult time having even a sense of them as being a teacher, much less even just maybe just a normal person. And because of that, there can be antagonism, hostility poured onto the big teacher. And the big teacher may be hated, certainly hated by those who are evil, but sometimes hated by even students or friends or anybody, because they're so unbelievably misunderstood. And why are they misunderstood? Because the things that they are doing, the consciousness they're employing, is so beyond most human beings, they just don't get it. They apply their own personal standards to the motives of the teacher and or the teacher's behaviors and teachings. Nothing makes a logical sense to a person who can't understand, through the lack of sense, what they're experiencing. They just make stuff up. They're trying to make it make sense. It's called confabulation. When you can't figure out and you don't have thoughts or memories about what to do about something, you just make it up. And that's what happens so often with some of these teachers. Okay, that's a toughie. Then what does a leader do with a smaller, the little teacher kind of concept in comparison to the big teacher? Well, leaders have a much easier time dealing in groups where there's just a little teacher, a teacher who isn't going through these awful tests and problems. The groups generally move more smoothly. The leaders have a much, we'll say, more copacetic relationship with those around them, the members, etc. Yeah, it just makes sense if you think about it. You know, yeah, that would make sense. You know, and those groups have a better chance of succeeding in their spiritual service, even if they don't know that they're spiritual groups. They have a better chance of succeeding. So we see a lot of success with little teachers and little leaders working together. That's a good thing. Now, what happens when you get a bigger leader, so to speak, one who is willing to make greater sacrifices and will take greater levels of consciousness and then expand it on in within themselves with a bigger teacher? Those groups tend to have, we'll say, erratic outcomes. Some of them are successful, thankfully. A lot of them fail because of the stresses of most people being unable to be aware. the leader also, the pressure on the leader is much worse when you have a big teacher, because it's the leader that allows others to see the teacher. And the leader is forced to be more creative, to deal with their own selfish desires and sometimes their angers and frustrations and hostilities about others not following any kind of consciousness that they exhibit from the teacher. And so this is a frustration for them. And it can lead to some, a lot of aberrant behavior and wrong kinds of leaders trying to do things in wrong ways. And it also leads to a complete alienation sometimes between students and others that come in contact with the big teacher, because they can't figure out who this big teacher is. This is some of the more, we'll say, esoteric problems, but they're realistic too, that takes place in those kinds of groups. And the longer the group is together doing this, is the spiritual way, which put it more like a world service group, even though they may not know that they are, doesn't matter. The results can be that you have a dissension consistently and in a very, we'll say, problematic ways. Does it always resolve itself? No. And does it always lead to some level of success? Unfortunately, the answer is no as well. But at the same time, plugging on and doing the best that one can, which is called nobility and the highest virtue humans can do, is a worthwhile venture regardless of the overall success or failure that in some tangible way may be exhibited within the group. Interesting stuff, huh? And then for those groups, the majority of whom do not know that they are a spiritual group, it's extremely confusing to those folks. I mean, you actually can have some fairly advanced groups where most of the members don't know that they're in a spiritual group, but they seek to create a great deal of virtue and light in the world. How do they respond to all these serious, we'll call them complications, and exacerbations between the interactions of members and non-members to each other? How do they deal with that? Well, this is why there are some teaching groups around, to help those groups wake up and say, oh, that's really because we are a spiritual group and we are doing these things, and there's these esoteric reasons that nobody can figure out unless it's explained to them by someone who has already gone through it or who has the consciousness to explain it. And luckily there are some groups that do that. One of those groups, I would say, is the group that I'm a member of. But the point is that all of this has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not people believe in a certain faith or a certain kind of religion. That you could have a disparity in all of that issues. It still applies in an esoteric sense to someone who is within what, by my definition, of what a spiritual group is. So that's the whole point of this. Spiritual leaders and spiritual teachers have to contend with all of the issues, and a lot more that I have so far brought up. You can see this is a more complicated subject than it may have seemed on the surface. And today we're going into it a bunch deeper than I ever have, because I don't think most people really get it. Now, I know there's a section in the textbook, Life's Hidden Meaning, where people can read some about spiritual groups. And most of what I said is one way or another mentioned in there. It's just unexplained in a full enough detail so most people really understand what I wrote. Somewhat because of the brevity of the book itself, even though I know it's a huge book, but each topic had to be covered in a very succinct, fast way with few examples, leaving the reader having to try to conceptually understand things rather than use examples which are easier to learn from. Okay, so let us take a little bit of a break here and just talk about a couple things. Last week I mentioned Dr. David Stacy's eye center, and if you haven't heard about it and or if you haven't tried them. And if you live anywhere in the Phoenix area, particularly on the east side, he has an eye center in Chandler. Now, what do I like about him? He's humble. When you meet him, you might say, oh, this guy ain't a doctor. Because he doesn't act like he's a doctor. Yeah, humility. He has humility. And those who work with him have humility. And he tries to work with each person and what they think they want to achieve, not what he believes they should. I really like that about a doctor, especially an eye doctor. If you're not satisfied with the means and ways you're getting to see or not see, he'll work with you to try to figure out what you want and whether you can get there or not, and he'll do everything he can to let you make the decision of what way to go on the situation. I like that. That is a sign of a good doctor. His demeanor is amazingly humble. He doesn't come off of, oh, I know this, I know that, I'm so special. He actually spends a good portion of his life in service to disadvantaged people, in helping them to see better, without most of the time without any remuneration. He's not getting paid. And even if you go to his eye center, he has some of the lowest prices in town. And, I mean, that's pretty amazing because he has some of the most advanced ways of improving eyes, using some of the newest technologies, at least, that can be used from that angle. Now, I believe in other ways of treating eye vision as well, but that's a different story. This is a man who has served many in many ways, and he is willing to try new things that oftentimes other people don't because it's expensive and you don't make much money doing it. And yet he is doing that. He wants people to be able to see whatever he can help them to do that within, or they can help themselves, and that's what I like about him. He's over at 2974 North Amel School Road, suite number 3, in Chandler. And it's really on the corner of Amel School and Elliott, if you know where that is. So it's a great place. It's called the iCenter.org, if you want to look it up, the iCenter.org. His name is David Stacy, and if you want his phone number, it's 480-899-0188. Give him a call if you're in the area, all right, or if you want to go to that area to see him. Also, I want to mention that you still can get 5-Qi Jizik at a tremendous savings, and if you haven't tried it, you should. Why? Because if it doesn't work for you, send it back and get your money back. And right now, it's almost half price. It's great. You can get it at buyjizik.com, buyjizik.com. You can call 602-431-5762, and you can buy it that way. You could go to Healthy Habits. It's a great vitamin nutritional store, supplements galore, over on 7th Ave and 7th Street, and Bethany Home. And check it out there. 602-431-5762 if you would like some 5-Qi Jizik. Why not? You can get it there. You can get it there, or you can get it from the calling the number, or going to the website. So you've got a lot of possible things that you can do, and you should try them out. Okay, we're going back to our show tonight, and let's get into some of the issues now. How is it that we can improve our spiritual leaders and teachers, and improve the overall? We'll call it service of spiritual groups, even though they may not call themselves that. How do we make improvements? Well, at the present time, so little is understood about what people are actually doing when they live their life spiritually that the first thing that should, and I think would be of help, is for people to be more cognizant and conscious about what the process is that they are actually living. So this thing that most people don't know, that they're in a spiritual group, probably needs to change. And the reason it needs to change is that when we take conscious efforts and use those, we are able to create better, and we're able to change ourselves more in accord with the needs of the service that we wish to contribute. This is a critical element, a very important one, by the way, for people who seriously want to make a difference in the world. The idea that maybe 75-80% of all spiritual groups don't know or wouldn't call themselves such is no longer probably going to be a good thing. Why it wasn't good before is you didn't build as much spiritual ambition in some of the people who, especially leaders, who focused their attention within those groups. So you had less split discipleship as a result, but split discipleship is on the rise, even so, because people are more arrogant these days, and the change in the third ray, this year particularly, is causing a lot of crystallization, even within some of these spiritual groups. So I think it would help, rather than hurt now, for these people in these groups to awaken. Now, how do you do that? Well, maybe just someone says it to them. If you know someone who's doing some kind of spiritual service, and there may be a team or a group in some business or occupation or whatever, you might mention to them, do you know that this is a spiritual group? They'll probably look at you strangely and say, well, we're not in a religion. What are you talking about? And you say, well, spiritual doesn't mean religion. It just means that you're doing God's work. You're serving others in a way that's selfless. And that's what you're doing. Well, we're making money, aren't we? Yeah, you could make money and be a spiritual group. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. As a matter of fact, if you don't make money, in some circumstances, it counters the spiritual mission of the group, because then the group can't survive to finish what it's doing or to do what it's doing. So part of it is profit. You got to make a profit. Oh, I know, if you're a socialist or whatever, you might say, well, the government will pay for it, or maybe we'll just take it from the rich. Well, that's wrong. The best way is to earn the money and then use some of that money, if not all of it, to further your goals in creating virtue. But it's okay to earn money to live and buy things even, and have some of that money left over for reserves. It's all okay. It really is. If you think differently, then maybe you should email me and we can have a conversation about it. All right. So, spiritual groups need to be better informed that that's what they're doing. I know it's hard to believe, but it's as much as way over three-fourths of the groups that don't know that. And today, it would be a significant value to both the leaders, teachers, members, non-members, everybody, if they knew what the heck they were really doing. It really would. Okay, so that would be kind of my first suggestion for making some changes and improvements in what has been a system that has lasted for literally over 1 million years. So it's I know. There's only been people on the for 10,000. There's been people for much longer than that. We just don't know that. All right. So let's move on to the next thing that I think would be really assisting. I think that it would help if there was direct available teaching by the teaching groups, the second rate level groups, about how leaders and teachers are designed and help them to design for themselves ways of becoming better at doing this and to deal with the aberrations that can develop from either role and to recognize and help separate these two roles in some of the groups where it's a confusion. That would go a long way towards, we'll say, improving significant numbers of spiritual groups. how can that be done if the second wave groups are compromised in the same way? Well, first they got to get their act together. And the leaders and teachers in those groups have to do an exemplary job in disciplining, spiritually disciplining themselves, so that they can be of help to many other groups, including and especially those that the majority, who are in the majority and don't see themselves as spiritual. Seeing yourself as a spiritual group allows you to consciously focus on being a soul without regard to the question of religion, which is so often confusing. Too many people confuse spiritual with religion. It's not the same thing. Religion is a method or means in which God invents or creates, and which people, invent or create, means of understanding and co-creating with God. It tells you what to do, in other words, in that genre of God. Spiritual groups are not, by that definition, a spiritual group. Spiritual groups actually help people to find God for themselves. They're almost the antithesis in some ways from some religious groups. And it doesn't invoke, therefore, in people the consternation and problems they have in being with or for or against church doctrine or religious dogma, because there is none. Spiritual groups and the leaders and the teachers in the group need to be aware of this and be proponents of it, which some are not because they get confused with religious groups. Spiritual groups need to help others to remember, think for themselves, grow their own consciousness, not adopt a doctrine that they haven't tested in their own life and find to be true outside of what others have told them, especially like a priest or a pope or a prophet or a elder member or whatever. You see, that needs to be impressed also in the realm of the esoteric factors that create people into spiritual groups. And until we make it less esoteric and more obvious, we're going to have these great conflicts that are so often seen. What are some of the conflicts? The misunderstanding of what is and is not a cult is one of them. I said at the beginning of the show we would be talking about this again. I've said it many times, but I don't think people really understand it. What in the heck is a cult? Well, a cult almost invariably is where the teacher is the leader, and instead of being the correct leader, the correct leader, remember, leads by example, is very careful not to force others to do anything, and only uses any level of mental force when it's to prevent somebody from harming themselves or others or doing something criminal or terrible. I mean, you know, those kinds of things, of course, you might do anything to try to prevent somebody from hurting themselves or others. That's a different issue. That's a rare event. We're really talking about basically in a spiritual group, you almost never see the antithesis, which is this incredible forceful nature, which leads to inevitably abuse, and I mean major abuse of power. Not necessarily physical, but it could be that too. It almost always leads to the leader of the group being the teacher, and the teaching of the leader is in accord with mundane advancement. In other words, they get to be special. They get rich in terms of money. They usually expropriate all material elements onto themselves for almost complete luxurious living with disregard for the spiritual mission, if they even have one. Their mission oftentimes is to grow bigger, which is evil, by the way, and it's also darkness. So you'll almost never find a cult of 5, 10, 15 people. You'll find a cult trying to get 10,000 people, or as many as they can get. It might only be 50 or 100, but it's always numbers that they want more than service that they give. And then whatever service they do is usually with all kinds of strings attached. They're getting something back in almost every element of spiritual service. That's way different than a spiritual group. Spiritual groups are trying to help others to become more spiritual. They're functioning as souls. Cults are attempting to segregate themselves into a position of power and control over anybody that they can do that, to take from those people, not give to them, and to use them as a means to the benefit of usually the quote-unquote leader, teacher, great one, with a few collective people around them. Now, why is it so hard to see the difference? As I define it, it seems obvious, right? The problem is that cults hide and pretend that they're spiritual. That they do that very well, because the leader, spiritual leader, teacher being and his upper echelon folks, or her upper echelon folks, are working with them, attempts to put out a message that looks like, oh, we're very, very giving to everybody. And they, unless you go in and look at the opulence and the ways that they live, which is oftentimes in, you know, huge houses, almost palaces, with, you know, they take vacations and spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars just on themselves. And they do many other things which are like dead ringers for, oh, there's something wrong here, you know? But the most important thing is that they don't try to help people become souls. They only try to help people become slaves. You are enslaved to me. Now, why do other people not see this? What is it? They can't miss it, you know? The problem is that the dark side wants the cults to look like spiritual groups and the spiritual groups to look like cults. They try to reverse everything. So they'll look for anything about a spiritual group and say, see, it's a cult because they are doing this or that, which may have a slight tinge of sacrifice and other things in it that resembles people being slaves. But it's done on a volunteer basis. And if people want to, they can just leave. They can say, I don't want anything to do with this. And, or, if they choose not to leave, they have a voice in what's going on. They can say, I don't like this. And they can choose not to take that voice and then claim that they're being forced to do something when they're not. But that's usually because they've gotten possessed in some way. They've gotten taken over by a darkness within themselves. And then in that situation, there's no hope for them because a spiritual group can't force someone to change. They can only help them if they choose to. So that's the difference. The cult can force people to be dark or to be slaves. They can force them. They use physical force, and they most of the time use intimidation and a whole bunch of other means that are really dark. The problem is defining and revealing the difference between these two things is no easy thing for those outside and looking in. And it may not be easy even for some members who are confused and themselves may be somewhat dark. They may think they're in a cult when they're actually in a spiritual group, or vice versa. It can get very, very strange. Sometimes the people in the upper echelons of cults actually believe they're in a spiritual group, even though they are selfishly abusing and taking from those around them. And they're doing so without any concern because they have convinced themselves that, based upon what the great leader tells them, this is a spiritual group. That's the difference. The safeguard of it is spiritual groups almost exclusively, and especially today this should be true, try to use something called spiritual hierarchy of thought. They're usually not successful. But what it means is everybody tries to get on the same page and come to a universal decision about the big things. Not the little tiny things, not about those. The big things. If they're going to decide to devote most of their attention in spiritual service to a certain area, they do it collectively together. And usually, almost exclusively, the teacher's not involved in the actual decision. Leaders can, the teachers can't. Because the decision comes from the each member being almost universally in agreement with the other members. How can they do that? Through a singularity in consciousness of seeing God. It's only through seeing God that they can do that. And the members that can't may not be able to function within that consciousness. It's called spiritual hierarchical consciousness. And if they can't, they may become a problem. And they may not be able to stay in that group. And unfortunately, if they leave with some kind of great dissension, they may never find another group to serve them. They may try, but they'll find that their service is no better and oftentimes worse than what they were doing in the first place. The commitment to serve is a soul choice. It's not a personal one in a spiritual group. Unfortunately, the commitment to quote-unquote serve in a cult is a personal choice, even for the slaves. And what are they getting out of it? Usually security. And someone bossing around makes them feel like, oh, gee, I feel secure now. I'll listen to the great leader who'll tell me to do this and that. Or his or her, associates that are doing the same. And maybe they hope to get into that elite clique of a couple of people. And remember, cults are very large and oftentimes exceed 50, 100, 200 people. Spiritual groups, as they advance, get smaller and smaller, not bigger. Isn't that strange? A lot to know about. A lot to know about. Okay, so leaders and teachers in spiritual groups will not permit their spiritual group to be a cult because they would leave it if it ever became one. And it couldn't because you almost always have to have this figure who is both a leader and a teacher, quote-unquote. They may not teach really any truth, but they teach something. As the figurehead. And it's so opposite of the way real spiritual groups work that it becomes black and white. But unfortunately, to some people who are confused, who have a lack of consciousness, they may not see it that way. It's a tough one. Darkness always wants us, or evil always wants us to see the darkness rather than the light. And that's why we either don't see the evil or we think evil is evident, which is a terrible, either way, it's terrible. Terrible result. And it would love for us to do either because it could cause us great dissension. And it destroys life to do either. Yeah, it does. All right, so what about some other elements of spiritual leaders and teachers need to be changed for a future that is brighter, that's going to be more helpful? Well, what are the issues of spiritual discipline? What do I mean by that, spiritual discipline? Is that like when somebody says you've got to do this or that? Well, other than a leader, as an act of extreme, we'll say, necessity, that doesn't happen in spiritual group. It's by suggestion, it's by help, it's by teaching and reasonableness that it's done. Now, what happens if you've got a bunch of wayward disciples who basically aren't even functioning spiritually at all? Well, yeah, you may have to use some degree of mental force. Mental force is what? Where you say, this is what you need to do because otherwise these are going to be the terrible results to everybody else. I'm saying that you need to do this in this and this way. Try it, and if you can succeed, then we'll go to something else. I'll be of assistance. Now, this has to come from the leader. It cannot come from the teacher. But that's the rarest of circumstances. It happens most in some of these more real esoteric groups I talked about earlier. In the more normal groups, that isn't necessary. Because in those groups, the leader has usually a closer relationship with the members and even non-members. And it helps them to be able to interact in a way which is non-threatening, non-forceful, non-compulsive. It allows for a group that usually grows without great strenuous, we'll call them crises. And that's the thing to try to avoid, see? Seemingly inevitable crises that are happening in so many spiritual groups today. Most of those crises are coming as the third ray becomes crystallized and communication is going down the toilet. People can't really communicate well together. They don't know why it's so hard. Why is it harder today than 5 or 10 years ago? Because of this esoteric reality. I want you to think about it, those who are listening, and see, challenge what I'm saying by looking at your experience in your own life. Are people not returning your phone calls as often? When, if it's forced any kind of significant communication? How about even emails? How about, how often are people communicating with you and vice versa? Remember, it goes both directions, about key elements that are important to both of you about some plan that you have. And how often has that gotten worse and worse in comparison to what it was, say, 10 years ago? Those are the things to test out some of the ideas and theories that you hear from me. All right. So this, in terms of spiritual leaders and teachers, this has become a, we'll say, a primary problem, and it has caused more and more spiritual groups to fail. Now, when they do fail, the real terrible part about it is that most of the people in the spiritual group do not in that physical lifetime of those people serve again in any significant way. You can say, well, why not? Why don't they get it? They leave 6 months and then they come back and say, hey, everybody get back together. Let's finish the spiritual group. Well, because it's a selfish act to leave or break up a spiritual group in any fashion. It's evil, actually, in some circumstances. And so once you get into that mode, coming back from that place is a tough one. If you do some real bad things, it's hard to face those things, which is the only way you come back, and to accept them and take responsibility for them so that you can undo them and become a great soul. So it's tough. If you do things that are real selfish, and unfortunately, leaving, disrupting, hurting, destroying the spiritual group is a very selfish thing, the results are that you almost never get a chance to come back because you have to undo so much of the karma. The karma is very slow, but it's insidious and almost unstoppable. You got to do an awful lot of good to overcome the karma, and most people just don't grow to that level of goodness necessary in the same physical life to undo it in the physical world. You can do it in the astral, and you can do it in the mental for sure, after physical death, but the physical world still suffers from the loss of so many spiritual groups headed by so many people, or not just headed by, but membered by so many people who unfortunately are swallowed up by their own selfishness. The results are pretty devastating. Group service groups actually can survive better with that selfishness because the people come and go so often. Every 5 years, they're gone. So even if you get a bad apple, a couple of bad apples, the group can survive. There's hundreds of thousands of people are in it, and it averages out. National service groups, and particularly world service groups, do very poorly with even one or two members who could completely destroy the group by just being selfish. Because they have fewer members, very few. A world service group oftentimes has less than a dozen members. So one or two members, and you've got a group-ending experience going on. And so to try to prevent this, maybe if we can awaken those that are most selfish before they take the extreme measures that they might take to be so destructive, they won't do it. Maybe. Why would they awaken by teaching rather than some other means? Well, in most cases, they're too arrogant to live by example from the leader of the group. They'll reject the leader and be challenged by the leader. So the thing that really can do it, if you can catch it early enough, is that the teacher has to be bold enough to reach to levels that breaks through the arrogance of the students, and at the same time has to be compassionate enough to convince the student that their ways of darkness and evil will they'll still be in standing and still be loved if they can change their ways. So as soon as they start demonstrating any improvement, then everyone in the group should do everything they possibly can, and the teacher should be encouraging them to do this, or the leader should be an example of it, of reversing the roles of trying to discipline and help from the more negative side to being pleasant, loving, helpful to the person. That works as long as you're not dealing with some extreme form of mental illness or some other kind of crazy thing where nothing's going to help because the person's not even there. If they're possessed very badly, it may not work. But on the people that aren't badly possessed, possession just means that they've been so selfish in their world, they left themselves open to evil, being able to affect the way they feel mostly and somewhat the way they think. You can get through to them, and you can change them around by, you know, the carrot, I call it the carrot and stick approach, but it isn't that you're punishing them at all. It's that you're only trying to help them to discipline themselves when they're acting out. But the rest of the time, if or whenever they are not, you try to show love, gentleness, acceptance of them turning around and try to work with them as much as possible. Do not think this is going to happen on everyone. I guarantee it won't. Some people will be so possessed they'll be gone no matter what you do. Others may have other specific issues with them, and they may use those issues or abuse those issues as reasons for living. But nonetheless, it gives you a chance. And it isn't always going to work, and there's always going to be some folks who just can't maintain themselves within a spiritual group no matter what is going on. They may project and make up stuff for why they, oh, I can't do it because of this. The real reason has to do with they're just too selfish. They've gone too far in being possessed by dark entities and things. And they also usually have a preponderance of arrogance. And it's the arrogance that can oftentimes be the bittersweet issue. And what do I mean by arrogance? It means that they not only think they're right, they don't care about anybody else's thinking or behavior. They have no caring for anyone except themselves. And this is truly the foundation of what psychology calls a personality disorder. It's just a bad personality. It's a personality who doesn't care about life and only cares about itself. It's sort of narcissistic. And when personalities get into that, they seldom want to leave or let go of control. And that means they get set in their ways, and it's difficult for them to get out. So, spiritual leaders, teachers in all groups need to be trying to resolve these issues, because they are big and they happen often, trying to get as many of the members to function as spiritual beings, to give in a selfless way, to open themselves to a number of areas of sacrifice, not the areas they choose to sacrifice in, the areas of sacrifice that they need to sacrifice in to be of greater service in general, and especially service as a soul, I'm talking about. That's such a big thing. I'll tell you, it's a really tough one, but it's a big thing. And if we could get to that point, we would save a number of groups. It would be helpful. And the leaders and teachers, if they understand some of the principles I'm saying in tonight's show, there's a good chance. There's a good chance we could save 2/3 of the groups we might lose otherwise. And losing a spiritual group is like it's like losing a body part. There aren't that many in comparison on Earth, in comparison to the number of people who have rejected God and are living a darker life. And it's not easy, even if you enter one, to be able to do anything effective with them, because so many of them have so many, we'll say, problems, fetters within their existence that restrict them from being of the service they would like to be. They may even espouse to be. So this is another good area to consider if we're going to make some changes, both in leaders and teachers' approach. Now, let me also mention some things about the very most advanced teachers. If there aren't very many of them, first of all, if we're numerically counting them, the functional ones are in the low hundreds, and it's very small, and some of them are in groups that are basically failing. And so, I mean, it isn't like we have just a plethora of these folks around. How is it that, with this small number, that these really advanced teachers can make any difference at all? Well, I'm still thinking about that because it's not an easy answer. Some things that are just thoughts right now is maybe, even though they're supposed to function within their groups and alone, maybe they should really start working together, because at this point, it doesn't seem as though even the majority will succeed in some of what they're here for. Now, that's kind of been, in the past, forbidden. And the reason it was forbidden is because part of this whole plan is that these people are so far advanced, they're supposed to, at the end of each life now, they're supposed to make their own advancements without too much assistance from anyone else, which would obviously include others of their kind. I think maybe that's going to need some modification here on Earth. Earth is so complicated and so screwed up, I'm not sure that the present rules, so to speak, governing esoteric matters like advanced teachers of the humankind are supposed to do this or that, is going to actually work. I'm concerned that adhering to some of those tenets may actually cause failure. But there needs to be a more open and direct communication about the natures that these teachers are having and how they can maybe collectively solve it for themselves. And maybe that's going to be the one thing that can divert the evil waves that are coming and destroying so many spiritual people. Another suggestion that I have for those spiritual leaders in that position is that maybe there can be some alteration in the process as what we call leaving or finishing the renouncement aspects of life in a physical sense to become a new being. Some people call them masters or superhumans. But to make yourself into that, maybe there is some new kinds of ways to consider the process than the older ones, which I don't think work too effectively in a modern society. Let me give you an example of that. Let's say that in the old system, which is still the present one, by the way, esoterically speaking, these advanced beings, okay, advanced humans now, we call them arhats or whatever. They have in the past and still are, working predominantly at some stage of this arhatness, particularly the beginning stage, under the most detrimental of issues so that they can face failure. Well, why does someone have to face failure and actually fail? To me, facing failure does all the trick you need to do, and you still can try to succeed with a real genuine expectation that you're going to be able to do that. And I don't think, at least as far as I have seen or as I understand it, that is what takes place in the present-day system. So I think there needs to be a more creative way of expectations being that success is possible, but outside of the normative ways that used to work before there was such a technologically advanced society with so much arrogance among the students of these teachers and all others around them. With unbelievable levels of illusion and ignorance, so that there's animosity at levels that were never even experienced, even in the days of Jesus, who was obviously had a great deal of animosity and was put to death in the most cruel of ways, of course, in the terms of the religious stance, he was resurrected, but we all are resurrected, all human beings. He was just resurrected in a way that was more visible, since in my belief structure, his etheric body was visible to his students and certain other people, which was made that way, so that people could understand that death was just a change of bodies and consciousness. In that case, for about 6 weeks he was in his etheric body, that's where the upper room issues come in, and then he went on to live his life as an advanced being in the astral world. But he still was not, in my opinion, yet, for that lifetime, advanced enough to make it into the next kingdom. That took a whole other additional lifetime. But I know that that is sacrilegious to some people, and they would consider it a real serious conflict for them. That's okay. I'm just giving my example. Well, then who was the Christ? Christ was his teacher. And who he and the Christ were basically one being, but regardless, if you don't believe that, it's okay too. It doesn't matter. The point is, obviously, this was a great being, yet, with all the problems that that great being had, and it's still, I think, worse today. Yes, the ignorance of 2,000 plus years ago was horrible, and the methods and means of punishment and cruelty were very big. But there's another kind of cruelty. Mental arrogance can lead to a total disregard for life itself, which is God's growth. And the propensity to become evil is actually greater today than it was 2,000 years ago. Isn't that weird? Yeah. And so this is our problem. We have the expansion of evil in a world in which barely anybody believes in it. So it's dangerous. It's really dangerous, because that's what evil wants. Okay, so what are some of the other things that I suggest? I suggest that leaders and teachers actually become proponents of getting the world to understand that evil does exist, and that it can exist within spiritual groups, and even has a propensity to, under certain bigger teachers' teachings, where the group can't really see the teacher anymore because it's so far advanced that they just don't get it. So those groups have been in greater danger because evil could proliferate in them, and then you could have some very negative consequences, but it wouldn't happen if the teacher and the leader exposes the evil as much as possible to inhibit people from becoming evil themselves within that group and fighting it in evil against evil groups whose sole purpose is to destroy God through destroying God's growth, which is life. This, to me, would be probably an excellent choice for making some changes in the way that leaders and teachers presently function within groups. Another thing that I think is of concern, and I have a teacher, and my teacher suggested this, is that groups not be so segregated along the race structure that they tend to follow in their service. As an example, a second-rate group that shouldn't just teach. Teaching is a major part of what they do, but we have a complex world today where you have to be somewhat adept along other ways than just teaching. If you segregate yourself to just teaching, even if you do a good job with it, the chances of recognition by the people who need to be served is going to be limited mostly to the folks who also are second-rate people. That problem is not good for today, because we don't have enough spiritual groups to go around, and the spiritual groups have to become more adaptive they have to become more proficient in doing things along other ray types of ways, than just teaching as an example, so that that can be visibly and palpably expressed by some many other kinds of available groups. That also tends to inhibit the growth of evil at the same time. This is a way that leaders and teachers could make some significant improvements in the overall system. It is more complicated. Let's face it. Hey, teaching, once you get it down, isn't all that bad. But now if someone says, well, now you've got to go function under the third ray, and you've got to go through this or that and change energy and be able to basically function in a world very foreign, a lot of folks say, hey, forget that. It's too hard to do. Or be political. Maybe you got to go do something political. Well, so what? It's hard to do, but do it. This resistance to adaptive change is pretty strong because, again, the esoteric system for so long has been one way. I'm suggesting these changes because if we don't adapt, evil can beat us. And the world could end, this world. Yeah, we could all go live in another planet. I've got my dibs on a 4th-ray one right now. But I say, look, it's a sacred 4th-ray one. Would be my first choice. But, you know, that's in my fantasy. In reality, I know that this is where I chose to be. This is where it's most difficult, probably, of maybe every place in this galaxy. This could be the most difficult planet. And it's a real toughie. And it's where the test of evil is so prominent. And evil is trying to gather its strength to not only take over the astral nature, but the mental nature. And join the two together. That's a real dangerous Kama-Manasa connection. And that would be, it would spell the end of this world. We're not that far away. 50, 100, 150 years, it could all happen. I don't expect it's going to happen next year, but we can make a lot of movement in that direction if things don't go well. We've got to awaken, and that means this adaptability has to become much stronger. And the willingness to face it, the fact that we are living in a pretty much evil world. That is so far from the word sacred that I think almost none of it applies to Earth. Almost nothing on Earth is truly sacred. That's unfortunate, but true. Well, we're running out of time for right now. So I do want you to think about some of these ideas about spiritual leaders and teachers and how there needs to be some changes if we're going to really make inroads. We're really going to do what I think, as souls, we came here to do. And besides that, I hope tonight's show has further revealed and helped the understanding of what a spiritual leader and a teacher is and what it isn't, and what a spiritual group is and what it isn't. Okay, well, we are out of time. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.